The 1950s and 60s were a time of medical paternalism in America. The doctor, who was male in 98% of cases, decided what was best for his patient and unilaterally made decisions which were rarely, if ever, questioned. In 1969, Dr. Marcus Welby was the TV prototype of this godlike paragon, and he spoke decisively and with authority in countless American households, including my own, on a weekly basis. This paternalistic approach to medical care affected both male and female patients, but had a much more profound impact on women since they regularly required medical intervention due to childbirth and gynecologic issues. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. The 1950s and 60s was also a time that the likelihood of having a hysterectomy was at its peak. Estimates suggest that the annual incidence of hysterectomy in 1935 was 2.4 per 1,000 women. By the 70s, it was 11 women per 1,000. And that's on average. In many socioeconomic groups or parts of the country, the rates were significantly higher. So why? Why did so many women back then end up having a hysterectomy? That's more than double what we see today. A lot of people blame it on societal and medical paternalism. Male doctors made decisions for female patients. Combine that with an economic incentive to remove as many uteri as possible, you end up with a lot of hysterectomies. But there's more to the story. The gynecologists of that time really believed that the large number of hysterectomies being performed was benefiting women who otherwise would have suffered needlessly. And there was some truth to that belief system. Before the 1970s, there were few alternatives to hysterectomy. Things like endometrial ablation, uterine artery embolization, fibroid removal, hormonal treatments, and other modern approaches to gynecologic conditions did not exist. Removing the uterus was pretty much the only option to treat gynecologic conditions that caused severe pain and heavy bleeding. And just as important, for the first time in history, surgical and anesthetic techniques had evolved such that a hysterectomy was relatively safe. I mean, we take for granted that today the overwhelming number of women who have a hysterectomy survive and have a relatively uneventful recovery. That was not always the case. And a historical perspective helps to understand that it wasn't just paternalism that drove hysterectomy numbers up. During the 19th century, the time of Civil War, hysterectomy was attempted only as a very last resort, and more often than not, resulted in horrific pain followed by death. I mean, only the most miserable, suffering woman would agree to the procedure out of total desperation. Anesthesia, as we know it, didn't exist. Alcohol was their anesthesia and would hopefully induce enough unconsciousness to allow a bunch of men to hold that woman down so the surgeon, who was probably as terrified as the woman, could do the surgery. Antiseptic technique and chloroform anesthesia wasn't introduced until the late 1800s. And although pain, complications, and mortality was still extremely high, at least death after hysterectomy wasn't a near certainty. It wasn't until the 1940s that the availability of antibiotics, anesthesia, and sterile technique made hysterectomy a reasonable procedure, as most women were expected to, and usually did, make a full recovery. Having said that, hysterectomy 40 styles was very different from today, when most women have an outpatient laparoscopic or robotic procedure and are back to their normal routine within a matter of weeks. My dad was a physician who studied in the 1940s, so I took a look at his 1941 edition of his gynecologic textbook, Crossan and Crossan's Diseases of Women, to get a picture of what it was like for a woman undergoing hysterectomy during that time. Okay, so the patient was generally admitted to the hospital at least 2 days prior to surgery so she could get sedatives to, quote, quiet the nervous system. Following multiple pre-surgical enemas, the abdomen and pubic region were shaved and bound with sterile dressings. This is before surgery, followed by a hot vaginal douche. 1 hour before she was taken to the operating room, she was placed in a quiet, dark room and given plenty of morphine. The purpose of this was to alleviate any pre-operation anxiety, which was, quote, troublesome. I think it's so she wouldn't panic and run for the hills. Anesthesia was administered with an ether mask, and the incision, the bikini incision, had not yet been invented. The abdominal incision started at the pubic bone and went well above the belly button, and it was often intentionally off to one side instead of in the middle. Following surgery, the patient was immediately given small amounts of water to induce vomiting. I mean, vomiting was the best way, really the only way, to clear ether out of the system. Now, think about this. You have a woman who's just had hours of surgery with a ginormous abdominal incision, and the first thing they do when she wakes up is to force her to vomit multiple times. No surprise, it was not unusual for a woman to inhale some vomit into her lungs. Never a good thing. In those days, aspiration was usually lethal. On the second postoperative day, assuming she survived, the woman would be given another enema to help her bowels kick in. By the fourth day after surgery, it was time to prop her up in bed for the first time. And even if she was able to urinate without difficulty, she was still catheterized every day in order to irrigate the bladder with antiseptic to decrease the risk of a bladder infection. The only good part of 1940s post-op care is that every patient got a daily massage from their nurse. On the eighth or ninth day, sitting on the edge of the bed was permitted. On the 10th day, the dressings were removed and she was allowed to get out of bed for the first time, but only if she was felt to be doing really well. Women who were, quote, worn out by ill health or heroic work for their children, meaning they were exhausted from taking care of five little kids while her husband went off to work every day, were kept in bed for an additional 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, sometimes I wonder if the women in the 1940s welcomed a hysterectomy just to get a break. Total hospital time for an uncomplicated hysterectomy, uncomplicated, averaged 1 month. And then once she got out of the hospital, women were told to limit their activity for at least 3 to 6 months. And this whole scenario, of course, only applied to the uncomplicated cases. While hysterectomy wasn't nearly as risky as in the early 1900s, the complication rate was still really high. Infection, anesthetic complications, hemorrhage, and blood clots, probably from lying in bed for weeks, were common. And then there was the surgical sponge problem. Surgical sponges were small, not routinely counted as they are today, and were sometimes inadvertently left in the patient's belly with disastrous complications. 25% of patients with retained sponges died. The ones that didn't die had long, drawn-out recoveries. Surgical techniques continued to improve, and by the late 1950s, hysterectomy was routine. Women could expect to have a much safer surgical experience and a far shorter recuperation with excellent survival rates. This was largely as a result of advances made during World War II. Since, like most wars, changes in medicine, surgical techniques, and anesthesia were exponential. And remember, in the 1950s, hysterectomy was still the only way to treat common problems like fibroids, bleeding, and uterine prolapse. There was no ultrasound or other test to determine if a pelvic mass was ovarian or uterine, benign or malignant. So hysterectomy wasn't just about treating gynecologic conditions. It was also used for diagnosis. I mean, if you're a woman in the 1950s and the equivalent of Marcus Welby tells you after a routine exam that something is growing in your belly and the only way to know if it's cancer is to take it out, you're going to say yes and not ask a whole lot of questions. So while it would be easy to chalk up the huge number of hysterectomies to arrogant men who were telling women what to do, given the perspective of the times, it's a little more forgivable that they were actually proud to be able to help women in this way, even if it never occurred to them to include her in the decision-making process. And then there was the Catholic problem. A hysterectomy was a legitimate solution for Catholic women who were not allowed to use any form of contraception or get a tubal ligation. I remember older gynecologists telling me that hysterectomy was a much appreciated form of birth control for women who otherwise would have continued to have yearly pregnancies. It was slightly problematic that often the woman wasn't asked. The OB decided for her to relieve her of making a difficult decision. During my residency, I was doing an admission history on a woman who was in the hospital waiting for hysterectomy. I asked her why she was having a hysterectomy, and her response was, well, Dr. Nevo said I needed one. So I said, well, did you ask him why? And she replied, no, why would I? I asked him about it later, and he said, oh my gosh, that poor woman has had 12 pregnancies, and this is the only way for her not to have another one. I discussed it with her husband, and he was in total agreement. To this day, I have no idea if she was in on it and just pretended to not know, or if she truly had no idea and this was a plan cooked up between her husband and the doctor. And she wasn't the only one. The surgical diagnosis in all those cases was always uterine prolapse. I mean, it makes sense since the only way to legitimately remove a perfectly normal uterus was to say that it had dropped. Once it was removed, no one could question the diagnosis. And it wasn't just Catholic women that were advised to have hysterectomies for reasons that today would never happen and make no sense. Studies from the 1950s through the 1970s show that up to one-third of these operations were performed for reasons that would appear illogical today. For example, uterine prolapse, a dropped uterus, and uterine infections were believed to cause back pain. In those cases, the cure for back pain was hysterectomy, and it usually helped. But it wasn't the removal of the uterus that got rid of the back pain. It was 4 to 6 weeks of bed rest during recuperation, followed by months of being told to take it easy. Had the woman skipped the surgery and been allowed to get off her feet instead of cleaning the house and hauling laundry and groceries up 4 flights of stairs, her backache would have resolved just as well. But whether it was a bogus reason or a legitimate reason, women rarely questioned the recommendations of their doctor. If they were told they needed a hysterectomy, the response was not why, it was when. Arming oneself with information from the internet was obviously not an option. So you put all of this together and it starts to make sense that by the 1970s, over 500,000 hysterectomies were performed in the United States. And while a social structure that promoted doctors to a godlike status that should never be questioned was part of the story, it was far from the whole story. During the late 1970s and early 80s, everything changed. The women's liberation movement was in full swing. Our Bodies, Ourselves, published in 1970, was a roadmap for women who were no longer going to let male doctors make decisions without consulting them. Manifestos such as Seizing Our Bodies and The Hidden Male Practice, How American Medicine Mistreats Women, sold millions of copies and created a much-needed awareness of how many women underwent unnecessary and undesired surgery. For the first time, women took control of their own health, questioned the established authorities, and a patriarchal medical system. And for the first time, women demanded to participate in decisions about their own bodies. The tide turned, and the flood of automatic, inappropriately hysterectomies dramatically decreased. And by the early 1980s, hysterectomy procedures were cut in half. So ultimately, it was politics and feminism, more than advances in medicine, that put an end to the rise of inappropriate hysterectomies. So this was a good thing and a necessary thing, but like many good things, the pendulum swung a little too far, resulting in the premise that hysterectomy should never be done except in life-threatening situations. Hysterectomy, like a lot of other things in medicine today, became politicized. Diatribes against hysterectomy proliferated, the theme was that most were unnecessary, and performed only by greedy doctors for financial gain. So we went from an era in which hysterectomies were performed too frequently to an era in which women believed that hysterectomies should never be performed until every other option had been exhausted. And as a result, many women unnecessarily put up with pain and felt compelled to seek multiple alternative therapies that never were going to solve their problems, which is an equal injustice to women. When I wrote my first book, The Essential Guide to Hysterectomy, I did a national survey of thousands of women who'd had a hysterectomy and asked the question, was your hysterectomy the best thing or the worst thing that ever happened to you? 82% said it was the best thing. I also asked if they'd been offered alternatives to hysterectomy. The 18% of women who said it was the worst thing that ever happened to them pretty much said across the board they were never given any other choices. And then I surveyed women in our gynecologic practice who had undergone hysterectomy and asked the same questions. 98% said it was the best thing that had ever happened to them. Our patients, of course, had been extensively counseled before their surgery, and if there were other viable options, we offered them. They had a say in the decision and determined that hysterectomy was their best option. Which brings me to the theme that is the basis of every topic I talk about. Every woman who faces a medical issue or decision, whether it is a hysterectomy, hormone therapy, or the ability to terminate a pregnancy, should be provided with information in an unbiased, scientific way so that with shared decision-making with an expert, she can make appropriate decisions based on her needs and desires. The key is that every woman must have the opportunity to weigh all of her options to determine her best option. Someone else does not get to decide for her. So thanks for sticking with me for this trip down history lane. I love this stuff. And if you do too, check out my Substack post this week, which is about the historic treatments of severe cases of uterine prolapse before hysterectomy was an option. You might want to skip the part about the leeches. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker. Thank you for joining me. For more information, along with access to articles, webinars, videos, my newsletter, and much more, go to substack.com/@Dr. Stryker. That's substack.com/@Dr. Stryker.